them down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Is it possible that one of the most significant events in all of history left absolutely no trace in the archaeological record? Welcome to the program. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest wondered the same thing, and so he began his own research. But because he's a filmmaker with more than 20 years' experience, he put his research into the form of a documentary film, founded Thinking Man Films, and his very first production explores the 3,500-year-old mystery behind the biblical story of the Exodus. If the Israelites really spent 400 years there and emerged to form a nation that is even today at the very center of geopolitics, why isn't there any record in the archaeology? Our guest, and it is our honor to welcome him to the program, Timothy Mahoney. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
The film is Patterns of Evidence, and this is a topic that I've been fascinated with for quite some time because I wonder the same thing. We've seen the Cecil B. DeMille film with Charlton Heston, you assume that something that immense took place that resulted in the birth of the nation of Israel, which is still existing 3,500 years later, which in itself is a miracle, that we should be able to find some trace of it amongst all of the ruins that have been discovered by the archaeologists working in Egypt. What was it about this mystery that prompted you to begin an investigation that's culminated in this film?
Oh, I think that I was probably like a lot of filmmakers. It sounded like a great idea, a great adventure to go off into. You know, a lot of films that are made just raise questions. They don't actually answer any because sometimes they believe that there just isn't an answer to be raised. I mean, there isn't an answer there. So basically, a lot of projects are such that you just go on the adventure and you say, well, I wonder if it could have been this. I wonder if it could have been that. And you show a lot of pretty scenery. But what ended up happening was that when I first went to Egypt, it was right after 9/11. That's when there weren't a lot of tourists there, by the way.
I can imagine.
Time. We made our way to the different areas where the story is said to have happened. And there were a couple things that were happening at that time. One of them is I went to a dig site to the actual area that would be considered the land of Goshen in the eastern part of the delta. The Bible calls it Goshen. And this area today is known as Tal Adaba. And there is a dig site that's been going on there for 20 or so plus years, maybe 30 years. It's been quite a while. And an archaeologist, Manfred Bitek, has been there slowly, meticulously working his way through that area. And underneath that area, that's the area of Ramesses, by the way, who we've heard about. You know, the mill
sure
has made the film about Ramesses, and different people have used him in different films, because the Bible talks about them building these store cities of Pithom and Ramesses. And so Bitek started digging in this area. And there's a level here. If we talk about archaeology, there's one level here, and there's different levels that work their way down. And so as they dig down deep into the archaeology, it uncovers times of history. Something that's below something is older than something that's up here. So this is older than this, and this down here is older. And so as they go deeper into the ground, they find things. Very interestingly, when everyone thinks about the Bible story of the Exodus, what they think about, because of this mention of Ramesses, is that the events of the Exodus happened during the time of Ramesses. And so when I went to this location and I said, have you found anything? And remember this layer here at Ramesses? He said, so far, not. We have scanty evidence of this. And he said, I believe that they came somewhere around this area and this just didn't happen. And I returned home after that month-long trip in Egypt. It was like, I liken it to, because I was raised as a person, my mother believed in the stories. She told us the Bible stories, and they were significant to us as a family. And, you know, people continue to challenge you. You know, they say, well, You're going to believe in those stories. But as I grew older, I was curious, and I wanted to go to those, see, hey, is there any evidence for it? But after I came back from that dig site, there was almost like this seed of doubt that was in my mind started to work its way into my heart.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe everything that I had been taught and that we had believed and that many people believed was not true, because this archaeologist said, you know what, I've been there and I haven't seen anything.
Hmm. So what was it then about the follow-up research that you did that led you to question the analysis of Mr. Bitek?
Well, you know, I came home and I started looking at this material, and I had done quite a bit of filming. In fact, I was looking for the route of the Exodus at that time, and we were searching for crossing sites, and we went to the Bitter Lakes area and to these different locations where the lakes were on the Egyptian side, and we went to the Gulf of Aqaba and through Sinai, and we were looking at that. And then some people had said, well, what's the whole point in even searching for the route of the Exodus? Don't you realize the Israelites weren't in Egypt in the first place? And I was like, this was all news to me. And I think for a lot of people, a lot of people don't realize that that is the scholarly opinion, that this isn't even valid anymore to even talk about. And so when I came back, someone had given me a book, and I hadn't even thought about it for probably a year. And when I was in the edit suite, I'm at the office right now, when I was in the edit suite, this thought came to me. I was looking at that footage of Bitek, and I had this like cold chill come over me and said, maybe everything that you have been taught is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, I felt this thought came to me, stop editing. Get up and go to your office. And I'm in my office right now. And if you look back there, you'll see a bookcase over there. You know, mm-hmm. See it over there? That bookcase was still there, and I had a book in that office, and as I approached it, I just was attracted to it. It was like I had this thought that I needed to go look, and I pulled it out, and it was this book by another Egyptologist, David Roll, and I opened it up, standing right here, and I opened it up and I looked at it, and I started to see that he was talking about the Bitek site. Now, this is a providential moment for me, because I hadn't thought about that book for a long time, and I ended up opening it up and looking at it, and I could see that there was a completely different interpretation. And do you remember when I talked to you about Ramesses being here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, deeper underneath Ramesses is another city called Avaris, and that's what Bitek was doing. He was digging at that location. And so what ended up happening was that Wall was not a person who was looking for the Bible. He was just an Egyptologist who was saying, I think there's some problems here in Egyptology's dating system. And that's when I contacted him, flew to England, and met him for the first time, and I spent half a day with him and asked him a ton of questions and came back. And that was sort of the beginning of me having a whole new understanding. And I think that that's what this film, Patterns of Evidence, then has, over the course of the last 12 years, been unfolding. As you gain more insight into something, I think as a filmmaker, I was able to step back and I interviewed all sorts of different scholars, and I was able to put their interviews and we transcribed them, and we were able to create a large database and look at this information. And what we could see, we started to say, well, what if we started from scratch today and we were looking for something? And we didn't come with a presupposition. Because I think that there's a lot of people that have presuppositions about information or historical ideas. So, you know, if there's a path, and there's a path that goes along, and all of a sudden the path goes like this, and everybody from this point on goes this way, But you have to say, well, what happened at that intersection, at that V, that made that decision? And so we went back and we looked at that and said, if we were to not go down this path to the left here, what happens if we re-ask that question? Which direction would we go? And so instead of everyone then be falling off to this path over here, you re-examine the points of the question, and you go, wait a minute, we wouldn't go that direction today. But everyone's decided that that's the way the road of the mind should take you. And we said, well, what if you started from scratch and you look for six major patterns? And I think that that's what David Rohl was basically saying. Well, wait a minute, I see something. I see a pattern over here that's different. And he asked the question, if Egypt has challenges in their dating, what else would be affected by it? He said, all these surrounding countries. And that began over the last two decades for scholars to start to question, because Egypt's dating impacts all the rest of the Mediterranean, because it has the most artifacts that can be traced because of its climate. And so what ended up happening was that that's how this film started to really gain momentum. As we were doing it, we started realizing that there were six major patterns: arrival, multiplication, the enslavement of the Israelites, the judgment of Egypt, the exodus out of Egypt, and then the conquest of the Promised Land. Those were six major events that you would have to say, if a nation went through that, is there any time in that nation's history where something traumatic, something catastrophic happened? And when were these Semitic people into these areas? So remember when I told you about Ramesses and the city that's underneath it? Well, what Rohl was saying is that Ramesses was the location, but Avaris was the city. So when someone wrote about this story, about the Exodus, they didn't know about Avaris because it was gone. They were saying at the location of Ramesses, just as in our state or our city, we have cities that have a name that wasn't the original name, but today we know it as something. Mm-hmm. But so the name was then thought to be the time, but the name was actually the location is what this what we're suggesting in the film. So that this older city, Ramesses, is at the right location, buried underneath this city of Ramesses. So when BTEC dug further down into the archaeology, he uncovered the story of the Exodus, and that's what I found in that book, and that's what David Rohl was trying to say.
I've been aware of David Rohl's work for some time, and his work was really helpful to me in my own spiritual journey because of the evidence for the Exodus and his analysis of the dating of events and dating of the evidence that's been uncovered in Egypt. Again, to just emphasize the significance of this location to listeners, this is in the land of Goshen, where the Bible tells us the Israelites were settled because the Egyptians couldn't have the shepherds living in Egypt. The Egyptians were basically racists, and they wanted the Hebrews living somewhere else away from them. And so if we are to find evidence of the sojourn in Egypt, we would find it in this area at this location. The chronology of ancient Egypt. I've been a member of David Rohl's New Chronology mailing list for quite some time as well. How far off does he think the standard accepted dating of Egyptian history is from his analysis?
I think he thinks that there's in this third intermediate period in the film, might have a picture of it in the book here. He thinks it's several hundred years overestimated, that the dating of Egypt was over exaggerated because they synchronized with the wrong biblical character. Egypt's dating synchronized itself when Champollion first learned the hieroglyphs, and he was the one who broke the hieroglyphic code, and he went to Egypt, and at Karnak there is a location there that that both David and I, he took me to, and we met, and that is where there was a pharaoh called Shishak in the Bible, and there's another one called Shoshank on the wall. And at that spot, that particular spot is where this, where Champollion, the man who in the, well, it was around the 1800s, deciphered the hieroglyphs, and he was new at it, and he thought there was a connection possibly to that story. And in the future films, we'll talk more about that. We filmed that scene already. But in this, I don't know if you can see this, but in this book, you see this darker period right in this area right here. We call that a dark period because it's less is known about it. And this is the book, the full color, Patterns of Evidence, the Exodus, the Filmmaker's Journey. This is about 400 pages talking about the story We also have a new book by David Rohl that goes much deeper into this as well. And but what happened there was that the Bible was used to synchronize the history of Egypt in the very beginning. And then what David Rohl would say, which is kind of interesting, he says, well, from that point on, history's Egypt has been used to discredit the historical story of historical accounts because it can't find anything. And so what Patterns of Evidence does is explores, well, if you were to start from the very scratch, from the very beginning, with, you know, from the scratch of everything, so just start out plain, could you find a rival? And the answer is yes. Could you find multiplication? Yes. Could you find slavery? Yes. And we looked at all those things, and they all happened, but they happened a little bit earlier in Egypt's history. And so what he's suggesting is that Egypt has an overinflated area. And he is not a person who's trying to defend the Bible. He's just saying, treat it like a historical document. He didn't come from this from a Judeo-Christian perspective. He was coming from it from a scientific perspective. So I think that's important to know.
Mm-hmm. No dog in the hunt.
Right. And so what ends up, so, but for me, it was, I have to tell you too, that there are other patterns of evidence that will, you know, that he's uncovered and that others are, we're looking at that are quite significant, and they all are showing up earlier. And it's not that the entire history of Egypt moves, it's just that one section slides up a little bit. And I think that that, it was, I felt it was worth it because today you can go off to university and people will say to you, you know what, this, there's, you know, the archaeologists say there's no evidence for any of this. Mm-hmm. And you can say, time out here, let's go back and look at this. Hey, Patterns of Evidence. In fact, it would be fantastic for your viewers to show their teenagers or their college students, because you see, it's hard for them to believe in the Bible because some of them are being told when they go off to the university that this is just a fairy tale. And, you know, I was asking the same questions, you know, is this just made up stuff, you know? Is there any, and what I think, what I, as I've understood this, is that the Bible itself declares that it's a historical document.
Right. Yeah, Jesus himself affirms that Moses was an historic character, and so therefore if Moses never existed, if the Exodus is just a fairy tale, then either Jesus was ignorant or he was lying. So there's some pretty deep implications to all of this. That's one of the things that, I thought interesting. In the early part of the film, Patterns of Evidence, you show an interview with the radio talk show host Michael Medved and a very prominent rabbi who says that it doesn't really matter. I mean, the story's not true, but I believe it anyway, essentially, is what he's saying. What is the significance of the evidence for the sojourn in Egypt? Why does it matter that we find evidence to document that that actually happened?
Well, first of all, I think because the Bible positions itself as being a historical faith. I think that most of the, I think of all the faiths, the Bible itself wasn't given, you know, it wasn't something that I think was created out of someone's mind. It was written by all these different authors who basically are stating that that what happened in history at the time that they were around, or as Moses was documenting the stories of creation and the flood, and they went from oral to eventually Moses, the Bible says Moses wrote these down. He was telling the story from Abraham and Joseph and arriving in Egypt, and then he was telling the story of the plagues. So the first five books of the Bible are considered a record of God's and mankind's interaction from the beginning of time, from the very beginning of creation. And I think that if it's not a, if I'm trying to remember the question here, if it's not a history, then the whole thing is basically a sham. And I think that that's the, and a lot of people today go, well, how could miracles actually have happened? And the other question that people have is, which I'm going to explore later on, is this issue of the super and the natural. And God says, I am outside of the natural. I know the beginning from the end. You know, I'm the Alpha and the Omega. And what's fascinating by that is that when you look at things that are written that were prophetic, and you can look on this, we created this device called the Wall of Time. And it's a pretty interesting timeline that's very visual. And you can see when things were written. It's fascinating to say, okay, when was that written? When did this happen? When did that written? You know, and you look at it and you go, okay, so what's going on here? Is that it, what I've learned is there's a verse in Isaiah that says, God says, I'm going to tell you in advance what I'm going to do. And then you have to say, okay, what's the probability? Did these things really happen, or were they, and some people say, oh no, they were written after the events. And that's the question of the authorship and who wrote it and everything. So for me, and then we go back to Jesus and the apostles, and all this stuff is sort of a type and shadow. You know, it's sort of like these things are mirroring themselves, you know, and they kind of come together like that. So this type and shadow of the Old Testament and the New Testament, I find is very fascinating. That these things that are mirroring themselves, these themes that are mirroring themselves, and the fact that, and if we look at, Jesus, he quoted the Old Testament, you know, continually.
Mm-hmm.
And he quoted Deuteronomy, I think, more than any other book. So if this event didn't happen, then some people say, well, all I need is Jesus. And we don't have to know about any of that. But what's so interesting is that from what I can see, the early church fathers, the apostles, and everyone said, hey, if this isn't true, then we're hopeless.
Exactly. Most miserable of all men.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that what Paul said?
Yeah. Yeah. If our hope is in this life only, then...
Right.
Yeah.
So the testimony, our eyewitness testimony, so people saying, hey, I saw this with my own eyes. I was there. This happened. And they write it down, and they pass it on to generation, and that's the text that we have.
Mm-hmm. Now, David Roll was just one of a panel of experts that you consulted. How many folks did you talk to, and how diverse were their opinions?
I love talking to these people, and I consider them really, you know, I would hopefully consider them as friends. Now, I'm not sure if all of them consider me as a friend, but I consider, because I spend a lot of time with their interviews, you know, sometimes just years. And the interviews are very diverse. I think that all of the people, there's nobody with, let's say, that I met that had like an agenda that said, oh, I just don't believe in the Bible or whatever. They can't reconcile if it's not there. And if they look, if they're giving, in fact, I went to the hardware store and I bought a measuring stick, okay? Mm-hmm. I love these old school measuring, you know. There's something enjoyable about opening these things up and down.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so the measuring device that they have is one that they didn't create. They just have it. And what we're saying, you know, what basically is trying to say is that, hey, wait a minute. What if a section of this history is actually overinflated? And it needs to come down like this, and this history is a little bit shorter. And that is like, what are you talking about? I mean, that's the conflict that people are having with all of this. Because, well, how does that deal? So the film, in a way, is not about chronology, because that is a whole other film that we could make. The film is really about patterns. The question then is, why are the patterns where they are? And so... When I talk with people, I would talk to them about a particular time in history. So I would say, okay, over here, do you see anything? They say, there's no story for the Bible here. The Bible did not happen according to Joshua. I'm telling you, it's nothing. And then if you say, well, what about this story? You go, well, what's that got to do with anything? That's an echo. An echo is these ideas over here are echoing something over here, which then echoes to writers over here, and they take and gather those ideas and tell this story of their history. So Israel Finkelstein, who is a wonderful man, and he invited me to come and dig, and I'll hopefully be able to take him up in the future. He said that that's what happened. They took these echoing ideas, and then they wrote this history, and as a way of, in some ways, to control people religiously and politically. That says, hey, if you don't obey the leaders, and if you don't obey me, a priest, then God's going to do something bad for you, and he's going to throw you out of this nation. So their interpretation of these echoing sounds are that these people were doing it to control. Or was it divinely given here, and it was actually what was inspired, and the prophets wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the tension between these ideas.
So in Egypt itself, you say that there are a number of events that you needed to look for evidence of. You know, what would it look like if we saw an influx of people into Egypt, an influx of Semitic shepherds, the multiplication of these people into a distinct nation state, basically, and so forth. I mean, it would be really easy if we had found somewhere in Egyptian hieroglyphics the book of Exodus written down, but obviously we don't have that. What does the evidence look like, and how do we know then we can assign the evidence taken from what experts would think is the wrong time and apply it to the biblical story?
Well, let's just take and say, well, let's assume... Let's not have any assumptions about when things should happen. Let's just say, hey, there's a story. And this story had a small group of people coming into Egypt, and there was this person by the name of Joseph who would have probably been honored because he was second in command. He wouldn't have lived just in a small little mud hut. And his family came to this particular area. And then he died, and his family grew. And guess what? What David Rohl was saying is that BTEC has found not only this small group of people coming right to the location, but he saw a palace. But the palace was not occupied by an Egyptian. It was occupied by a Semitic person who had a throw stick on their shoulder. And this person in the garden, the main tombs of it, he had a pyramid tomb. And around him were 11 other major tombs.
Okay.
And so what he's saying, what Rohl is trying to tell us is that, and what he's saying is that if you look at the story of the brothers, they would have been, and Joseph forgave his brothers. And he said, God meant it, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. I think that was the text.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're seeing is that, he said, hey, BTEC uncovered a pyramid tomb with a Semitic ruler, and a 11 other main tombs in this area behind the palace. And very interesting, Joseph had two sons.
Right.
Now the palace had an occupation, you know, basic occupation area, and then it had an addition with two equal compartments. And so he's saying, and there's more on that I haven't got into, but that fits the idea, because it was first built as a one building or one main building, and then there was an addition put onto it. So the question would be, the hypothesis question is that Joseph's son? And so that's just one little part of the arrival. But the other thing about that arrival part of it is that the tomb was broken into twice. And when the Egyptologists uncovered it, the thing that they found was that the bones are missing. And Joseph, earlier on in the story, says, listen, I know you're going to go back. I know what this promise is. You're going to go back. I want you to take my bones with you back to the promised land. And that was when he was on his deathbed, that's what he asked his brothers to do. And so, very interestingly, is that this person who was the Semitic ruler, who in this unusual pyramid tomb, which only pharaohs and queens were given this high honor, his bones were missing from this area. which was very, very odd, because in any grave robberies, the bones weren't missing. And that's what David Rohl would be saying. He would be telling you that, that's not common. And so it matches the story of Arrival. Same matching the story of we see that community all of a sudden just grew and expanded into what would be one of the largest cities of the ancient world at that time.
That was one of the stories in reading David's book that I found really fascinating, that and the discovery of the statue in that tomb, which would have been the second time that the grave robbers went in there. They smashed up the statue, didn't they?
Right, that's right.
Essentially trying to deface it and erase any memory that these hated sand dwellers, the Hebrews, had ever been there.
Yeah, exactly.
So what about the pattern for the evidence for the Exodus itself, removal of people? According to the Bible, over 600,000 men of fighting age, but when you extrapolate that out to include the young, the old, the women, you could be looking at a couple million people. That would leave a pretty significant trace in history, wouldn't you think?
Yes, it would. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, this whole question of population, for me, one of the things that we've talked about in my own journey is that this is a crisis of faith, is that I think there are questions about, like, the question of how many people were there, how many people actually left, how many people could sort of sustain themselves on a exodus, and would there be any traces that, like, how could a million or 2 million people, you know, be in the wilderness with all these animals and everything? And I mean, that almost seems like it's hard to get your any practical reasoning around it. It'd be hard to figure out, you know, 30,000 or 50,000. And so, and I think that goes back to, I think your question is, you know, there would left some dent. And I think my understanding is that there was probably, at that time, I had heard a figure, and I'm not sure if this is exactly correct, but there was 3 and 3.5 million people in Egypt. You know, so there was a number of people already dwelling in the land of Egypt, and they were worried that there were going to be more people outnumbering the Egyptians than the Hebrews were going to outnumber them.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're thinking about, well, what populations actually were in the country at that, you know, back at that time, these numbers are actually closer to being accurate than if there was only 50,000, you know. In other words, why would the Egyptians be so worried if there's only, let's say, 20,000 people?
Sure.
If there was 3 million Egyptians, you know. So those are kinds of things that you have to look at and say, okay, let's start from scratch and let's look at, the whole thing objectively for a second time. But what we see at Avaris, and that there are some other cities, was that what David noticed was that this entire group, there was what seemed to be like a plague. That's what Bitek, the archaeologist there, said. Professor Bitek thought that it was a plague because there was bodies thrown in graves very carelessly, and they were in all sorts of different angles. And then the entire population disappeared overnight. And this happened also in another area called Kahun, further south. And so there was also an interesting thing is that around the Avaris area, there was probably 20 or 30 more settlements that we, you know, that, you know, if Avaris is here, all around that area were other cities. And they haven't been excavated because obviously excavation means digging up right in the middle of a city or in the middle of a farmer's fields or whatever. So it costs a lot of money to today go and dig down.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know what Professor Bimson from Trinity said. We don't know exactly what's there, but it would be interesting to find out if this group of these settlements also abandoned at that same time. So there's not just one city, but there could have been many, many cities that had this this population that left. That's the open question. But we know of at least two cities so far at around the same time that basically had this phenomenon.
Yeah, and one of the things that really startled me, and I don't want to spend much time on this because I know our time is growing short, was finding out that there was a period in Egyptian history where they were ruled by Semitic invaders, the Hyksos. And
right.
There was at one period a pharaoh by the name of Jacob. not probably the patriarch Jacob, but it was evidence at least of Semitic influence in Egypt during that period of history. And the Hyksos were eventually expelled by the Egyptians. I want to talk about a new aspect of the program,
I think you described
it before the interview as if the film and the companion book Patterns of Evidence are like giving birth to a child, this would be like having a grandchild. The Patterns of Evidence Young Explorers program that you're developing, this is something that I'm really excited about, because I really believe that our children and our grandchildren aren't learning apologetics. I didn't until I was in my 30s. And now, once I began reading books like The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, for example, things like that, that everything clicked into place for me. And, of course, David Rohl's work was part of that. What are you doing with Patterns of Evidence to make this accessible, this information accessible to younger people?
Well, we started seeing 12-year-olds and 10-year-olds, sometimes 6-year-olds. They were bringing their kids to the theater to see this film when it happened. And we heard that, in fact, I just heard today that this child sat through the entire event, and only towards the end of the panel discussion was, and I said, wait a minute, there's a huge interest here for kids. And there's particular kinds of kids that are, like, they're the little, they haven't been, they're the bright kids sometimes, but we've tried to make this film accessible for everybody, so it's very visual. And so, once I saw that, I said, I think we need to make a children's version. And we got the kids together, and we found a way, while David Rohl was here, we also filmed him with the kids in this old mansion. And so we go and visit him, and he explained some of this. And then we have another device where we created a location and an environment where the kids can explore, and we can go in into the Wall of Time. It's like a hologram environment where I can create an environment when we go into a room, and it's a green screen. You don't see the green screen. You can see whatever world we create.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids, these 10 different kids, ages 8 to 17, are moving about through all this, through their regular world, and then they meet me, and we go on this adventure. I said, do you want to go with me? And they go, yeah, we do. And so we go on this adventure to explore the stories of the Bible. And so we've got a series of episodes that are coming out, and I couldn't be more excited about this. And it takes each of the kids are given an assignment where they read the Bible first. They read what they're going to look for. This is the clues they're going to look for. And then we meet somewhere, and then we go off on this adventure. And we're taking all of the great animations and graphics from the film and moving it into this particular other film. So the Jericho footage and all that material, Joseph and the plagues, is all going to be in this new film. And we're going to make it so that people can buy it just for their grandkids or for their kids, give it as gifts. Or we're also going to work at coming up with homeschool and Sunday school curriculum.
That's fantastic, because I had to do that on my own, 20 years ago, trying to transcribe David Rohl's work into a format for junior high and senior high kids. But having it available in multimedia, especially today, would be very helpful for teachers who are always looking for high-quality material. And having somebody the caliber of a David Rohl and some of the other Egyptologists that you talk to providing the research that goes into this is really fantastic. How soon will the Young Explorers programs be available?
We hope before the end of the year that we will have some of the first programs available. And so that's the plan. We're actually filming in the next week. In the next 2 weeks, we're going to be filming some major scenes. In fact, I'm filming tonight part of it with one of the Young Explorers.
Cool. Now, Patterns of Evidence, the DVD and Blu-ray version, and also the companion book will be available by Monday, August 4th. In fact, by the time people hear this, probably it will be available.
I think August 4th is Tuesday. But
okay, correct.
And you're right. It's going to be at stores like Walmart. It's at Christian bookstores. You can go to patternsofevidence.com, and there's a store locator. And if you want to buy it, you can go to their websites, or you can go to the stores. You can also get a digital download and stream it. I want to, could I run and grab David Rohl's book?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. In the meanwhile, I'll mention the website, patternsofevidence.com, is where you can find out more about the book. You can see a trailer for the film, also get some reviews and that have been posted about the film. It was shown in a number of theaters earlier this year, and unfortunately, one of the drawbacks of living in a smaller community is that we weren't within an hour and a half of where the film was being shown back in Illinois. I think it was being shown up in Champaign. Well, maybe an hour. We were about an hour away, but looking forward to seeing the version on the Blu-ray player at home. And so I'll be making a run to Walmart with my mom, which is kind of a weekly routine that we do here. So I'll make sure that we swing by the DVD section there at the Super Walmart when we go by. Now, David Rohl, is we a major contributor, or did he actually write the book here?
Is this David Rohl wrote this book. This is David Rohl's new book.
Ah, okay, all right.
And it's he says it's the best book that he's as far as the production value goes. I mean, it's just loaded with mm-hmm. photography and graphics, and he explains his ideas in this book. And so as we work with different scholars, the plan is to continue to try and develop more, you know, books. We created Thinking Man Media mm-hmm. To basically create, you know, these new products. So, we've, you know, the books, we've got other books that are coming out, hopefully. That's the plan. And what we need is, there's, you know, we've got it on Blu-ray, and this is the Director's Choice, which is sold on our website, which has... you know, there's lots of products that we're trying to create, but what we need is enthusiastic help to go out and tell everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It took 12 years. This one, next one, we're going to be speeding things up. It took a lot of research for us to figure out how to start to put this all together. And now that we've got that, you know, a better understanding, and we've got distribution up, we need people to tell all their friends. You know, you can sign up and be a thinker on our website and get emails, and we send emails out to our people on our website. Those are emails directly from me, and I'm going to send one out, which is going to encourage people to go onto their email database and mm-hmm. send a blast out to everybody, because we've got a lot more to be told. There's a lot more patterns of evidence that have been uncovered that are fascinating, and I think the film has been a great tool as a neutral place for people to bring their friends who are skeptics or don't believe in the Bible. It's a great type of film to basically allow you to watch it and say, well, what do you think? What do you think about these stories?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I found it has something that has been able to cross both sides of the spectrum when it comes to people.
Well, you got a fan here already in the Missouri Ozarks, and anything we can do to help get the word out I'd be happy to do it. Like I said, I've been kind of a history geek my whole life, and this particular period of history, I mean, there are certain events in history that are so fundamental in shaping the course of events in human history. I mean, in America, I guess we could point to George Washington. You could look at Leonidas and the 300 at Thermopylae. So Europe developed with a Greco-Roman influence rather than a Medo-Persian influence, but certainly the sojourn in Egypt and the Exodus led by Moses, one of probably the five most influential events in history. Mm-hmm. And when you examine it, it is just incredibly interesting. And especially when you begin to realize that this is not just something you have to take on faith. It is faith that is based on patterns of evidence, which is one of the unique things about, well, Judaism and Christianity, as compared to other major world religions. So, again, anything we can do to be of help, we more than happy to do it. One final question for you, Tim. What do you hope viewers of Patterns of Evidence or readers of the book will take away? What is the one thing you hope that really sticks with them?
I think that for myself and, you know, for people that have seen it, that's a really good question to ask, because I think that there should be comfort to know that that there is a history that actually is showing up, and I believe that encourages people. What I've been told by some of the people who've seen the film is, you know what, I kind of wondered about all this stuff, and it made me more bold. It gave people more confidence, and that there's a historical foundation for, you know, the stories of the Bible. And, you know, I went as a person who was asking the question, are these stories true? And I came away, one archaeologist said, hey, I don't put the evidence in the ground. I'm just telling you what we see. You know, that was Brian Wood. He says, I'm not putting it in the ground. I'm just telling you what I see. And what I see matches the story of the Bible. So it's all there, and it's all there in the right pattern, in the right sequence. That's why so many scholars that I've been running into are excited about what this film is able to do. It's able to communicate something that hasn't been communicated before. And I think that that's what the big news is.
Tim Mahoney is the writer, director, producer of Patterns of Evidence Exodus, his first documentary feature film. The website is patternsofevidence.com, and I'll put a link to that and the Facebook group in the show notes at vftb.net. Tim, hopefully we can talk again, because this is a topic I could spend hours and hours on. For the benefit of the listeners, we'll keep it to a manageable bite-sized chunk. But, Tim, thank you for your work, and we hope this does well.
Thank you very much, Derek, for having me. Hope to come to your area, okay? Let's work that out.
Absolutely. Tim Mahoney, again, the man behind Patterns of Evidence Exodus, available on Blu-ray, DVD, and in hardback book beginning August 4th, which is Tuesday. He's correct. It is Tuesday. And not just via Amazon or through the website patternsofevidence.com, but through a lot of brick-and-mortar stores as well. And since the the trip to the Super Walmart is one of the high points of the week, we'll make sure that we pick up a copy while we're out, because I am a history geek. I'm not a scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but there are certain periods of history that really fascinate me. And this period of Egyptian history, for me, is one of those. The period around the time of the Hyksos and the expulsion of the Hyksos from Egypt, which I think more or less fits the narrative of the Israelites' Exodus, the Hebrews leaving Egypt in a hurry. But, you know, if I ever get the opportunity over a couple of cold ones to sit and talk with Tim or David Roll or Bryant Wood or any of the other Egyptologists mentioned in the film, I would love to do it and just be able to sit there and just pick their brains about their analysis and their discoveries. Because, again, this is a period of history that has had such a profound impact on the way we live even today. And for scholars to generally conclude that there's no evidence for it is just mind-boggling. And there's no wonder that students, assuming that their professors know what they're talking about, begin to question their faith when they're told, no, there is no evidence in the historical record that this event, a watershed event in history, left any trace whatsoever in the Egyptian sands. But that story about the pyramid-shaped tomb, the palace, and the 11 companion tombs around it, located in an area where the Hebrews, according to the Bible, were known to have lived, the land of Goshen, is immense. That could be the solution to the mystery right there. That could have been the palace of Joseph, the vizier to Pharaoh, and the tombs of his 11 brothers. Pretty astounding when you think about it. So I am definitely looking forward to this. And as Tim mentioned at the end of the interview, we had kind of talked before the interview, found out that he's got some family connections in the area. So we may be able to get him down here for an interview on Skywatch TV and hopefully coordinate with some other things. Because what he's doing is some really fascinating stuff with the outreach to kids. Just a couple of quick items in the news this week. Of course, more videotape released in the ongoing documentation, chronicle, I guess is the better word, of the trade Planned Parenthood has in fetal body parts. It got so bad that Planned Parenthood was able to find a sympathetic judge to issue an injunction against the release of any videos, but I think that will only stop it temporarily. Those videos and the folks at the Center for Medical Progress, who have been releasing these videos, showing the executives within Planned Parenthood haggling over the prices of baby parts. They said that there's plenty more video where that came from. And I predict that it will eventually make its way into the public. This is one of the biggest public relations nightmares in Planned Parenthood's history. And when you think about its origins and the way it's managed to reform its image over its history, it's pretty astonishing. Now, of course, there's a spiritual component to all of this. That's the whole point for even mentioning this during this program. The news that we see covered by the cable networks and on the newspapers on any given day are just the shadows against the wall of the actions of the principalities, the powers, the thrones, the dominions operating in the realm just beyond the limits of our human perception. Planned Parenthood, for many years in American history, were considered outcasts because people knew what Margaret Sanger was all about. She was a racist. She was a eugenicist who openly advocated for culling the herd. There's no other way to put it. Getting rid of those that we didn't want too many of in the society. And it was due to the influence of eugenicists like her that the United States had programs in place in some states that lasted into the 1970s where women were sterilized without their knowledge, because they were considered poor potential parents. And the danger is when the government takes on the role of deciding who is eligible to have children, who is considered good enough stock to breed. That's where Margaret Sanger came from. But somehow Planned Parenthood's image has been rehabilitated over the years so that, well, to the point that it gets $500 million a year in federal funds. That's almost half of its operating budget. And when you look at their tax returns, you show that they have excess funds in their tax filings shown at the end of the year. That's what we from the world of corporate business would call profit. But, of course, it's a 501c3, so you can't use that word. Well, Senate Republicans announced this week, finally, that they're going to draft legislation to defund Planned Parenthood. We'll see if that actually happens. But it's a shame that it took this type of citizen journalism doing the work that major news networks. I mean, where's Fox News been in all of this? Citizen journalists doing the work of real journalism. And the only response that most of the major media can come out with, or Planned Parenthood, is that, well, the videos have been heavily edited and it's an invasion of privacy. The videos that were posted to YouTube have been edited for length and for content. No more edited than any raw footage filmed by a network news crew is edited before it goes to air. You don't just throw the raw video up there on a network newscast. So anyway, but that's the best defense that they've got. Well, except for this, apparently, toward the end of the week, Planned Parenthood claimed that its website was being hacked. And was claiming that radical anti-choice, you know, clever word, they're anti-choice instead of pro-life. Words matter. Perceptions matter. And anti-choice sounds more harsh, dictatorial than pro-life. So, maybe we say anti-life for Planned Parenthood. Anyway, Planned Parenthood claiming that its web operations were attacked by extremists. But when some folks who really know what they're looking at did some digging into whether or not Planned Parenthood's website had actually been attacked, they found that it had all the earmarks of an orchestrated public relations stunt. Like somebody who found out that while Planned Parenthood was claiming that its website was being hacked, somebody was inside the website rearranging the CSS style sheets. If you're a web developer, you know what that means. Basically, they were just modifying the code internally, which wouldn't have been possible if the website were actually being hacked. Furthermore, the website, as of at one point, while again, the organization was claiming that the website was hacked, somebody looked at the source code for the main page at PlannedParenthood.org and found that the website was using a specific web template named Site Down Template. Yeah, really, really hacked. What else? Of course, we got another report this week from the Middle East that Mullah Omar, who is supposedly the leader of the Taliban, is dead. Now, it might actually be true this time because I did see a follow-up story that certain leaders from the Taliban had gotten together to elect a new leader, but we'll wait and see. Mullah Omar has been reported dead a number of times since 2001 when we invaded Afghanistan. The deal between Turkey and the United States to create an Islamic State-free zone in northern Syria leads one to ask this question. Has the United States, in making this deal, sold out the Kurds? The Kurds have been American allies since before we went in to take out Saddam in 2003. They were our allies when we went in the first Gulf War back in, was it 91? We didn't back them up after we pulled out and Saddam began unleashing, you know, unholy retribution on the Kurds in the years after Gulf War I. And it looks like we may be abandoning them to their fate once again. The Turks agreed as part of this deal with the U.S. to allow American planes to launch airstrikes against the Islamic State in Syria from the big air base at Incirlik in Turkey. But at the same time, the Turks, who were also bombing ISIS in Syria, they're bombing Kurdish positions in northern Iraq. And the Kurds, again, are our allies, and they've also been the only fighting force in the whole region that's been able to stand up to the Islamic State. So what's going on there? It's not really a surprise, the Turks' response, that is, because they have, well, they consider the Kurds as big a threat as the Islamic State. The Kurds want an independent Kurdistan. And much of their territory, most of it, in fact, is inside the borders of Turkey. If they were to form Kurdistan based on areas in which the Kurds make up a majority of the population, it would include parts of Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And none of those nations is particularly interested in ceding territory to the Kurds, especially because part of that area is some of the oil-rich area around Mosul and Kirkuk. But we'll see what happens. It looks, again, as though the Kurds are being used while they're useful and then abandoned when it no longer suits our interests. Unfortunately, the Christians that are left, the few that are left in northern Iraq, the Assyrian Christians, whose towns, whose villages were overrun by ISIS last summer when the Peshmerga, the Kurdish military, withdrew, are the ones who are going to really pay the price again. There are some Kurdish or Christian militia units now that are trying to defend those communities. They're working as allies, kind of an uneasy alliance with the Kurds. But it's a very unsettled situation. And this whole thing between Turkey and the Kurds could wind up igniting a much wider conflict in the region. Hope you find Patterns of Evidence Exodus as interesting as I do. I do think, as Tim pointed out, that taking this as history, because the Bible calls it history, is important, especially when you consider that Jesus considered Moses historical. And if Jesus was wrong about that, that doesn't make him a very powerful God, does it? If either he didn't know Moses was a fable, a fairy tale, a myth, a legend, or he was simply lying. Either way, if that is true, then again, that speaks to the legitimacy of Jesus as Lord and Savior. If Jesus is Lord and he affirms the existence of Moses, then Moses must exist. And Patterns of Evidence Exodus shows us where to find that evidence. Coming up on Wednesday night on A View from the Bunker, an interview that deals with a really interesting bit of entertainment coming out of Japan. In one way it just goes to show the cultural difference between the Japanese and us Americans. Also shows that I'm not in the target age group anymore. it's an anime series that's become a big hit based on a manga, which is Japanese graphic novel, I guess, a certain visual style, called Attack on Titan. The premise is that humanity is down to its last redoubt, a fortified area in which the remnant of humanity is gathered behind these immense walls to keep out these titans, these giants, who just mysteriously showed up one day and began eating people, because that's what titans do, apparently. And then after a lull of 100 and some odd years where the titans went away and people begin to wonder, do the titans actually even exist? Suddenly they're back, and they're back with a vengeance, breaking through the walls and threatening humanity's very survival. So the anime, which is the Japanese cartoon series, has become popular enough that a live action film is being produced. There's actually also a theme park in Japan where characters from the film, some of these giant titans, are recreated. And you can go there and have your picture taken in the grip of a titan about to eat you, if that's your thing. Steve Quayle had noticed this and mentioned it last time he was here in Missouri, and was surprised to find out that I not only had heard of the series, but I'd watched most of the anime series. So Taylor Kent and I will talk about Attack on Titan. Why is it popular, and what are some of the themes, memes, and messages in that particular series? Why is it so popular with American kids, too? It's really, frankly, it's pretty creepy. And I can imagine, I can only see the live action version being even creepier than the anime version. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, posts again on Sunday morning. Every week we post another hour-long study as we go through the Bible in chronological order. This past week we took a break from the book of Numbers and read one of the Psalms, a psalm that's attributed to Moses, because chronologically that's where it would have fallen. So that's kind of how we're going through things right now. But we're into the book of Numbers, which means very soon the Israelites begin attack on Canaan. So that will post mid-morning Sunday, and you'll find that at gilberthouse.org. On Tuesday night, Skywatch TV returns. I'll be interviewing Chris Putnam. We do a two-part interview beginning this week about his books, The Supernatural Worldview, and was very happy to be able to have that discussion with him in a video setting, and hopefully introduce people to the book who've not heard of it before. If you're a longtime listener to this program, you know Chris, you're familiar with the book, but there are people out there in the Christian Television Network viewing audience who may not be familiar with it. It's a little bit different. Well, of course, Skywatch TV is a little different from most television programs that you find out there in Christian broadcasting. I think the closest thing to it, of course, would be our friends at Prophecy Watchers. But anyway, that'll be on the Christian Television Network Tuesday night at 8:30 p.m. Central Time, UTC minus 5. Is it minus 4 right now? No, it's minus 5. Christian Television Network is DirecTV channel 376, Dish Network channel 267, the Glory Star Satellite channel 117, and if you don't have satellite TV, you can watch it as it streams to the internet. Christian Television Network streams its programming online at ctnonline.com, and it follows Prophecy Watchers, so just tune in half an hour early and watch Prophecy Watchers, then watch Skywatch TV Tuesday nights on the Christian Television Network. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker. Thank you.